Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to WriteStream Tuesday. This is your host, Daria Ann. I am an author, ghostwriter, social media marketer, and founder of the WriteStream Radio Network here on blogtalkradio.com. And I just welcome you to our show from wherever you are listening all around the world. I'm so glad that you're here. I've got another great broadcast lined up for you. But before we get to our two wonderful guests, I want to just remind everyone, do a quick programming note, to please check out the WriteStream Network, blogtalkradio.com/WriteStream, to listen to our two other hosts, Just Believe with Lisa Tarvez. It airs every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern. And this past Sunday, as always, she had a fascinating show with a guest, Christia Cummings, who is an expert in angelic communication. And both Lisa and I had readings with Christia on the air, which was very interesting, a lot of fun. She was a great guest. So if you missed that broadcast live, you'll definitely want to check it out. And then yesterday's Military Monday with military historian, author, and journalist John D. Gresham was a fascinating show because we turned the tables on John, and I actually guest co-hosted. I was the guest interviewer and had an opportunity to speak with John about the biggest literary influences on his career, the literary books and authors, the people and books that have really helped mold him into the successful freelance writer and media personality that he is today. So if you didn't hear that yesterday, again, just go to blogtalkradio.com/WriteStream to listen to the Military Monday archive from yesterday and previous episodes, because John always has interesting shows as well. And I'm very proud to have both John and Lisa as part of the network. Okay, well, today's first guest, I had originally intended to bring on prior to Mother's Day because her book is especially relevant for that holiday. But unfortunately, here in South Florida, we had a little storm a couple of weeks ago, and it interfered with my internet connection well beyond 1 p.m. Eastern time, and it was really too late to try to salvage the show. So we just rescheduled it for today. So I want to, first of all, take an opportunity to wish all the mothers out there a happy belated Mother's Day. And I wanted to just, before I bring on author and friend, Adrienne Meyer Mallon, and her editor, Paul Gettleman, I want to just go ahead and read her book description from her Amazon page. And the title of her book is called Mother Love, Now and After I'm Gone. And it's available in paperback and I believe in Kindle as well. And I'll talk to her about that when I bring her on the air. But again, I just want to read a bit from the book description on the Amazon page. An elegant recollection of stories shared by a mother to bless her sons. As Adrienne Meyer Mallon reflects on her life, it is apparent that there is a higher power, God, and her soul that has evolved through these stories. They all share a common theme to assist her sons in looking at their own trials and tribulations of life and perhaps finding an easier way to traverse life's tough times. Throughout all of the stories, there are lessons to be learned and a perspective upon which one can look at all of their own stories. There is fate and destiny, faith and angels, surrender and let go, let God, and so many more. This charming book is interwoven with real-life photos of her sons and memories taken through a period of almost four decades. The author, Adrienne Meyer Mallon, had no idea when snapping literally thousands of photos for dozens of photo albums that so many would adorn the pages of this book and enhance the stories. It has been one of the author's greatest joys and accomplishments in life to leave this legacy of thinking for her sons, for now and after she's gone. It is Adrienne's intention that these stories and perspectives will enhance her sons' lives now and in their futures. She has more love for them than she has ever been able to express, and so this is the medium with which she could best share that love. And that is absolutely beautiful. And so without further ado, I welcome to Write Stream Tuesday, Adrienne Meyer Mallon and her editor, Paul Gettleman.
Hello, Daria.
Hello, Adrienne. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Daria.
So, Adrienne, you know what? This broadcast is especially nice for me because you and I have a longstanding friendship through our involvement with Unity Church, which is where I first met you. And so I'm just delighted that you could join me today, and I'm really excited, and I'm just excited for you for having written the book, and I'm just thrilled to be able to bring you on to talk about it.
Well, you know, while you were describing the back of the book and reading that, I was thinking exactly the same thing, that so much of what I wrote had to do with what I learned at Unity and where you and I met one another. So I think that we met, and then we each became an author. I know you certainly did before me. And I think that church and its teachings is inspirational, and so much of it has shaped my life very beautifully.
Oh, absolutely. I feel the same way. It really prepared me and really helped open up that those lines of communication and that ability to really express myself. And I know the same is true for you. But Adrienne, let's start, for those of you who don't know, for the audience who doesn't know you, tell us a little bit about yourself first, and then we'll get into some specifics about the book and the writing process.
Okay. I'm trying to think what I can tell you about myself. First of all, I have two sons, which are the heart and soul of my whole existence. For my whole life, the idea of success for me was when my children are older and mature, that they would each one day say, when something wonderful happens, gotta call mom. And so I've been trying to write a book for them, that was my intention, for the last 7 years. And I started out writing a book several years ago, and I lost all of the chapters that I had written because I'm not very technically brilliant, as my editor Paul is. And what happened from circumstance is 7 years later, in July of this past year, I can tell you, but it would take too long, all of a sudden these stories started pouring out of me. I feel 100% certain that this book was written through me. And so I started writing story after story, and as I was writing the stories, I was seeing that there was a lesson to be learned, that some of these stories that provided so much sadness, drama, that so my phone is messing up a little bit, that so much of, I'm having a hard time with it, though, that so much of the story, purpose of the story, was to teach me something. Hold on one.
Sure. Gotta love these.
Hey, Daria, we're getting a bit of feedback on our receiving end.
Okay. Do you want to hang up and try dialing back in? Would that make
yes.
it easy? Okay. Go
That'd
right
be
ahead.
Much better.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay. Yeah, this is internet radio, ladies and gentlemen. We're used to these kind of technical snafus. They happen quite often. I'm actually very pleased right now that my Skype connection with Blog Talk Radio seems to be holding up very well. So Adrienne's going to call back in a moment here. And again, I posted a link to her book, her Amazon page, in the chat room. So those of you in the chat room, please check it out. You can look inside the book and sample some of it before purchasing. And I've read the book, and it's very touching. And especially, and I'm not even a mom, but, you know, I can just relate the love that she has and the wisdom that she passes down to her children. I can relate to that from having the same experience with my own mom. So it's a great gift. And let me go ahead and see if they are back on the line here. Adrienne and Paul, are you back?
We are here. We're on the microphone this time.
Excellent.
Anyway, now I can think. I started writing these stories. I found that there was a theme in all of them, that it was there to teach me something. What seemed very tragic or fear-provoking or difficult at the time that the stories were taking place were all transcended by my thinking now. And so I wrote ferociously. I literally hardly left my house. I was somewhat of a recluse for a little over 2 months. I just wrote and wrote and wrote. They just poured out of me. And one afternoon, I met Paul, who I had never known before, and it was somewhat uncanny, but you and I know there are no accidents. And Paul happens to be an editor and a genius on the computer. Suffice to say that these stories have blessed me. It was cathartic to write. And the stories, oh my goodness, I cannot begin to tell you how my sons are loving reading this book and learning more about their mother. Blessedly, they already think as I do. And I get accolades. Daria, I was at the bank this morning in the drive-thru, and one of the gals that bought the book, she said to me, I just want you to know that I've been sharing your book with the other tellers, and we read one story a day.
Aww.
And I'm just so gratified. I didn't have enough time to tell Paul, but the stories are really blessing people. I've had people in my ballroom come up and ask me personal questions. I sent my son off to military school, and where did I send him, and why, and did it help? And others that have come over to me with tears in their eyes saying, I didn't know this about you. And it's just been it's been like a birth. And just like a child, you don't know how life is going to be when you have your first baby. And this is my first baby, and it's been rather rich.
Yeah, and you know, Adrienne, when you were describing the process, I mean, you know, of having the book sort of channeled through you, I mean, I had a similar experience, and it's such an indescribable feeling, and it's just amazing. And certainly the feedback you get, like what you were saying with the tellers, it's hard to describe as an author how that makes you feel. I mean, so congratulations. I mean, that's really exciting. Now, what kinds of things are you doing to promote the book? Do you go out and speak to groups? I mean, how has that part of it played out?
Well, the thing is that after the book was published, I had a dedication to my sons, and my son came in from Tampa. My other child lives here, and I had this huge undertaking in my home. I had 40 chairs for the angels in my stories that had come in from all over the country that I literally read to and gave the book to my sons with all these people as witnesses and told one another at the party whom each of them were. It was an extraordinary evening.
Wow.
And after that, a few of my friends remained, and after that, I felt like, you know what, I don't want to do anything. I was burnt out. I put my heart and soul into this project for almost a year, and so while I would have liked to have done selling the book for Mother's Day, I just needed to take a break.
Yeah.
And what's really rather interesting is that people along the way have sort of picked me up. I have you today with the radio, and tonight I have a book signing. May I say where it is?
Absolutely. Please, plug away. That's why we're here.
So The book signing is at the Yaakov Gallery, which is in Royal Palm Plaza on Federal Highway in Boca Raton. And the book signing is taking place between 6 o'clock and 10 p.m. I will be there with a bunch of books and I believe a couple of other authors. I'm not familiar with whom they are. And so the point that I'm making is I really, really have a very spiritual-based heart. And I feel like when I listen to that wee small voice, everything turns out just right. So I've been listening and smelling the roses and taking time off. And little by little, this man met me in the parking lot and he said, "You want to have a book signing?" And so little by little, I'm finding that there are still the angels that are coming and making this book successful. I'm really not marketing it yet. I'm going to because soon I'll have had enough playtime. But for now, I'm sort of getting my groove back on. I want to help my son with one of his projects. And I feel like the book will last into infamy and I will be ready to market it when I'm ready. And it will be there and it's gaining steam. And I had a 13-year estranged relationship that the person wrote me 2 days ago to say, I can't sleep. I'm up all night reading your book. The love is so refreshing and your thinking is so phenomenal. And I thought, wow. I mean, it's finding its own way without my having to push.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Well, it was meant to be, for sure. Now, Adrian, can you tell us a little bit, like, so it only took you a couple of months to write it, right? You said about 2 months. It just kind of flowed through you last year. And so did you, at that time, just kind of for aspiring writers and anybody listening, because I always like to get into this with authors, as far as the process itself, did you, it doesn't sound like you had to deliberately think about how to organize it, but how is the book structured and how did that all come about?
Well, I love you asking me because I just love the subject. I started to go to Office Depot one day to get Dragon Naturally. I didn't think I could write it. I felt like I could speak it because I would go for my walks every day and I would speak my book. And I thought, wow, that sounds pretty good. And it was July 4th weekend. I had no plans, and Dragon Naturally, the process from Office Depot, it was learned that I could not utilize Dragon Naturally on my computer. So I don't really remember the first story. All I remember is that I spent the entire weekend, instead of being lonely, I spent the entire weekend at my computer, and it just started pouring out of me. And so as far as aspiring writers, I would say that the best thinking is for you to realize if you think you want to write a book, you will eventually write it. If you have to push yourself and sequester yourself to sit down and force yourself to write it, it's like looking for seeds that you've planted to sprout before their time. They're not going to come up, or when they do come up, I don't think they're going to be that good if you have to force it. And what I found in my own experience is that the book, as you said, channeled, it came through me, and I couldn't stop it. And my son, who was living with me at the time, said, "Mom, why are you in such a hurry? You know, go out, go dancing, have fun." And I felt like, Andrew, I've got the juice right now. I got to go for it while it's coming.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would suggest that if you want to write a book and you feel like your life is not complete and you're not the success you want to be in that realm, just forgive yourself, understand the process, recognize that you're still gathering information, and the right and perfect timing will occur. And if you let go, I got to tell you, let go, let God, I really do feel like all the pieces of the puzzle will come together and you will be able to manifest something that you didn't even know you were going to write. And as far as this book, I wrote every different story from every different year, whatever I could remember. I wrote a list of the stories. And then I would sit at the computer and I'd say, I'm going to type out 10 of them today. And they're only between like 2 and 8 pages.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time I had about 110 or so stories, I started feeling like, there's a common theme. And one day, I had a weekend of nothing to do, and I got pink paper. and I wrote on the pink paper, let go, let God, patience, honesty, faith, angels, signs, and I put them on my dining room table. I think there were about 15 of them, and then I ran off hard copies of the stories, and then I assigned each story to a pink piece of paper. This one goes under angels, this one goes under faith. And when Paul came to see me that following week, because we saw each other about two times a week, I brought him to my dining room, look what I did. And I felt like this was one step further. I was so proud of myself. And together, the ideas started percolating, and he started putting together formats, and I started thinking, oh, let's do it this way, and he started thinking, let's do it that way. And before you know it, it was, I can only liken it to a birth. There's specific things that occurred during the 9 months, and with Paul and I, there were trials, tribulations, there was laughter, there was frustration, there was, wow, that's great. There was, in the beginning, he would say to me, look, sweetheart, this is not going to be a bestseller. And I would laugh, and then all of a sudden, he started to feel like, wow, this is really great. I'm loving this. And so it's just been a very joyful, it's been perfect. It's been wonderful.
Well, that is great to hear, because I was going to ask you, and I want to maybe bring Paul into this conversation as well, because sometimes, you know, there's a little bit of tension between a writer and an editor, and, you know, the editor is so needed, and I can't stress that enough for aspiring authors as well, because, you know, don't just share your book with your family and friends and people who are going to think it's great. You really need it. You need that critical eye. So it sounds like that was a good collaborative process for both of you. Is that correct?
I have to tell you, and Paul, I'll shush and Paul can talk in a moment, but I think the reason why it was so perfect is because he, and this is not a plug, this is just the truth, he is so unbelievably amazing. I'm very, very much of a strong person. I know what I know and I like what I like, and he is also a very smart person. He's a smart man, and yet, being that it was my book, he stuck to what he knew, the punctuation, the grammar, the computer skills, the formatting, and I am totally humble. I'm not good at that stuff, and he felt like, look, you're the writer, and he didn't try to change. I've spoken to a lot of writers since, and they're a little frustrated with their editors because they tried to change the story, they changed a sentence, they changed a word. I must have had about 7 or 8 editors that all gave it a shot. And most of them just were my friends and tried to help me out. But a couple were professional, and they were like 100% of a turnoff. So a piece of advice is don't be in a hurry. Wait for the right and perfect editor, because Paul made this process joyful. It could have been frustrating, and then the book would have never been born. And so I'm just so grateful. That's why, again, I think it's a God thing that he sent me Paul. And now I'm going to shush and introduce my most favorite editor and good friend, Paul Gettleman.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Adam. Paul.
Adrian kind of humbles me when she speaks of my character and I guess my abilities, but there's one thing that I've really found very important from the beginning is that we both have a similar background in terms of our growing up. We're both from New York State. We have similar upbringings. I also happen to have two sons who I feel are the salt of the earth. Once I met Adrian's sons, I realized she had done a terrific job with her boys too. They are just a great character, great integrity. They're also beautiful looking, not just on the outside, but also on the inside. And so it was very easy for me to relate to the feelings and the story she was trying to impart, really to them. And she wasn't quite accurate in the fact that I did, in fact, change a lot of her wording, not to the extent that the topic itself was lost or the idea was lost, but just to make it flow a little more easily and to make it more readable for someone who really doesn't understand the whole process, the whole story itself.
Wow, that sounds good. Now, Paul, what is your advice for somebody seeking out an editor? I mean, and Adrian, it sounds like you kind of interviewed several people before you and Paul, you know, got together and you said, you know, this is my editor and we're going to work together to create this book. What are your thoughts on that? For anybody listening who's seeking out an editor, they might be kind of nervous about it because they don't want somebody, as Adrian said, to kind of change their whole story. What are some of the things to look for and some of the questions to ask?
Well, the very first thing, before you even think about getting an editor, you have to have your stories written. You have to pour your heart out on paper, not worry too much about the organization, how you're going to put one story ahead of another or behind another. You really just have to get your idea on paper and write it from your heart. After that, you have to, I mean, in terms of finding an editor, I don't think there's any tried and true method. I think you just have to perhaps seek out other authors, ask them if they know of anyone who is an editor, someone that they've worked with perhaps, someone who can relate to the author's material. You know, I didn't really look at this as strictly as an editor. I did this more as a friend to Adrian. I'm just as much in love with this story as Adrian is. I kind of denied that to her along the way because I wanted to keep her in line. But the bottom line is we are great friends. I think we will be friends forever. I really enjoyed working with her on this. There were certainly the moments of frustration because I guess, luckily, technically gifted to a certain extent. I've run my own computer business for over 28 years providing computer services. My editing experience actually came in a prior career. I worked in broadcasting for 20 years.
You can tell with his voice. Can't you have beautiful voices?
Yes, I was just about to say that, Paul.
Thank you. I appreciate that. It's nice to return to radio for a change. But no, the bottom line is I've done so much advertising and writing over the years that I have a certain style that I feel makes the written word readable to an end viewer or end user, so to speak. And I just wanted to employ those skills into Adrian's ideas. In other words, I just plugged it in and said, this is the way it should flow. And the end result in my mind is that Adrian has a great set of stories that really do involve spirituality, and makes you realize that there is a reason for everything. There is a gift in everything.
And I want to tell you a little bit about Paul and I. When you talk about selecting an editor, I never intended to write this book to be published, Daria, and everybody who's listening. I intended to leave this for my children. And I literally was going to go to Office Depot and have it bound, you know, type it out myself and bind it and hand it to them. And along the way, a friend of mine, and I'll give him credit, Barry of Barry's Vitamins and Herbs on Federal Highway, whom I dearly love, he said to me, Adrian, you know, you could publish this. And one idea led to another. As Paul mentioned, there are no accidents. There's a gift in everything. And lo and behold, I started to write the book. No, I had already written it, but I started to think about publishing it. And so I had different friends that volunteered that said, oh, I could edit it, and all doing it, you know, at no cost and just to be kind to me. And they would edit, you know, a story here, a story there, and I was in a hurry. I wanted to hand it to my boys, not that I plan on dying anytime soon, but I had an urgency. It has made me feel much more complete that they have this book now. And long story short, my advice is if you find an editor that either is not reliable or really takes his time or doesn't do what it is you're looking for, find someone else. Because I started to write a book about weight control and dieting and all that kind of stuff, the emotions behind that, years and years ago, and I really have a lot of good stuff in me. Very healing stuff. And yet the gentleman who became my editor was so into marketing that he took all of my excitement and enthusiasm away. He was all about money. This book is not all about money. This book is 100%, I mean, I spent money on this. And if I tell you that if I never see another nickel, I gave this book to my sons. My sons have, our love has grown in the last month. I gave it to them a month ago yesterday, the 13th of April. It has been so astronomically, I cannot explain it. It's just been too beautiful for words, their receipt of this book, and they're getting, even though we're very close, they're getting to know their mother in another realm. It's been astounding. Mm-hmm. And so my point is that if people are writing a book and it's coming from their hearts, they should pick an editor based upon what their heart tells them. And if they find somebody who's good and the price is good, but there's something wrong with the fit, be patient. There will be another editor. And Paul, by the grace of God, was sent to me, even to the point where he agreed to be my editor. My computer crashed that very weekend. He spent, he spent the entire weekend putting my computer back together, and at the end of the weekend he said, Adrian, I really don't think I have the time nor energy to be your editor. And I was heartbroken, but I felt like, you know what, I respect that, and I let it go. And about 3 weeks later, he was giving me another computer lesson, and out of my mouth, I wasn't planning this, I just looked at him and I said, I am so mad at you. And he was like, what? And I said, I want you to be my editor so bad. And he looked at me, and he's not a man that can be easily told what to do, not at all. And he looked at me, and I said, Paul, I'll do anything. Please, 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 please be my editor. I really need you. And you know what? He said, okay. And so this was not easy. You know, that it just bada boom, bada bang, you hire someone. So I suggest to your audience, take your time and write the right and perfect book. Find and select the right and perfect editor. This is your baby, and treat it. If it's not right, don't do it. Wait until it's perfect. That's my opinion.
Yeah, and that is great advice. And I've also had authors on the show dispense the same sort of advice when it comes to writers' groups, Adrian, too. I mean, you know, and I know that it sounds like this was a, you know, kind of a solo effort, and then certainly when Paul came in, a collaborative effort between the two of you. But I've had authors come on the show saying similar things about, you know, if you're in a writers' group and they're just giving you a barrage of criticism without giving you sort of on the flip side advice on how to make things even better, then that's just mean-spirited, and to really to be discerning and to go to different groups if that's what you want to do, and go to a writer's group and find ones that will offer you constructive criticism and also offer you alternatives. As to, you know, they should be interested in wanting to make you better, not just in tearing you down. And I think that's so important, because human nature too, let's face it, I mean, there's jealousy that we all experience sometimes as negative emotions, and certainly as writers, I think we have to be aware that that could also be coming into play with, when we ask other people to critique our work. So this is something you said reminded me.
I agree with you wholeheartedly. I went to one writer's group several years ago, and I would never go back again, because who says that the people that are critiquing you are any good? I mean,
right,
just because you're in a group. And so my personal opinion, I have started, I'm a life coach in life, and I've started to coach a few of my friends, three of them to be exact, and I basically feel like the same as the rest of my coaching, whatever I suggest that they do and they agree to do this week, we will come up with a success. I will never give them, and they will never accept an assignment unless they intend to carry it forth, like write me 5 pages. Are you willing to do that? Yes. And so I try and read and build success after success after success. And I feel like these writers groups, they're not my cup of tea. I've always been an individual. You know, I listen to my own heart more than others. And so my suggestion is, if you can find a dear friend or a coach, and not every coach is going to charge you a bunch. Some coaches do this because their hearts love doing it, which is myself. I'm basically retired, except that I'm a life coach. And so if anybody wants to come to me, I will be the person who motivates, the person who inspires, the person who believes in you, the person who knows you can do it, and you just have to produce. And I give you baby steps. So that's I'm not a group. I'm not one of those. They don't work for me.
You and I are so much alike. Yeah, I'm sitting here nodding along, going, I feel the exact same way. I just want to take a moment and let the audience know, if you have a question for Adrian or Paul or both of them, you can call into the show at 347-945-7246. Just keep in mind, Adrian and Paul, that I'm also the producer as well as the host, so I don't have a way of screening calls without taking myself off the air. So if somebody does call in with a question, it'll be an adventure for all of us as to who's on the line. And there was somebody from the 850 area code, but they seem to have dropped off. So caller, please call back in if you want to ask a question, and I'll make sure to get you on the air. So, you know, Adrian, the other thing I want to talk about, too, because you were talking about how, you know, you never really intended to publish this, and, you know, you're not a techie, whereas Paul is the techie person, and I want to get both of your take on this, but I'm so excited, and certainly this was the case for me back in 2008 with my book, that new technology has opened up so many avenues for authors now. I mean, the whole paradigm has been completely turned around. You no longer have to deal with the gatekeepers at traditional publishing companies who might say, well, no, I don't like your subject matter, or I don't like the themes of your book. I mean, we have so much freedom now to go ahead and write and edit and publish our own book. So, Adrian, I'll start with you. And what are your thoughts on that? And how has been your experience with, now I'm assuming you self-published, and yes. How did you go about that process of deciding which service you were going to use?
Well, I did self-publish, and I did not look into, usually I'm inquisitive to compare and contrast, but I didn't do that. My friend Barry suggested Amazon.com, and I got in touch with them, and they told me about CreateSpace, and I immediately went with them. As I said, I really wasn't looking to make money on this thing. We learned as we went, both Paul and I, he never published a book either, and I'm not 100% pleased. I think they were wonderful. I would heartily recommend them. They do offer services that Paul did that I didn't have to pay for. But at the same time, I'm a little bit frustrated. I thought that what I did pay for would get my book on offered at Barnes & Noble. And the book is offered if you request it, if you make a special request. And that's not what I thought I was going to have. I did purchase ISBN numbers, and those are numbers that you have to have that are listed in the Library of Congress for each and every book. I have one book that was color and hard copy, one book that was color and soft copy, one book that was black and white and soft copy, and you have to have an ISBN number for anything. If there's a punctuation that's different from one book to the next, you have to buy a new ISBN number. There's a lot to learn, but like having a baby. You don't know how to diaper the baby or do anything. You learn as you go. And so that was part of the joy. That was part of the frustration. And if I had it to do over again, I don't think I would have changed one thing. I might have changed the cover. It's really interesting. The cover of the book is one thing and the back is the other. And as I hand this book out to people that are purchasing it, they look at the front. And seldom do they look at the back. I think I would have had the back become the front. But I'm learning. See, for me, the comfort is that my boys have it. That's all that matters. I'm not beating myself up for anything. I would love to make my money back because I did spend money on getting it published. But as far as whom to go to, if you're not having the book flow through you at this time, then spend your time looking at different publishing houses, different deals. You know, spend your time doing the thinking stuff. When the heart stuff comes, drop the investigation and just go with the writing in your heart. So I still think I have a lot to learn. There are some people that are looking at my book that might want to publish it under a different label, and I was able to purchase an ISBN number that would give me that freedom. So I don't really know where this book is going, but it seems like it's going someplace because there's been a lot of interest. So
wow.
I'm a ballroom dancer, and I could be with 600 people on any given Sunday night, and so many of my friends, and it's sort of working its way through the ballroom. She wrote a book. You know, the lady who serves the food, she bought one. I mean, it's really, it's fun.
Yeah.
It's been,
that's another thing we have in common, Adrian, which is pretty awesome. Hey, let me, our caller from 850 area code is back on the line, so let me go ahead and bring this caller on, and it'll be a surprise for all of us.
Okay.
Caller from 850, you're on Right Stream Tuesday with Adrian Mallon and Paul Gettleman. How are you? You have a question? Hello, do you have a question, caller from 850? Okay, I guess not. I was trying to bring them on the air. Paul, let me ask you, do you have anything to add in terms of, you know, the advancement of new media in, you know, in the publishing industry? What are your thoughts on that, you know, the positives and the negatives?
Well, I think it's all good. To me, being a computer science technologist for almost 30 years, the Internet is just, to me, an amazing road. It's so expansive, and the technologies that have developed within it and outside of it that run in association with it are amazing to me. I feel like, thank goodness I was born at this time of my life. I am really enjoying technology as it is. Now, regarding the actual authoring of a book, it's as simple as getting at your computer and opening up just a simple notepad and typing it just as you would on a typewriter, if that technology were still around, which has pretty much faded away at this point. But simply pour your heart out, put your ideas out there. To me, once you've done that, the editing, the formatting, the creation of a book will follow fairly easily. The technology is there for us to all put it together.
Yeah, I've certainly found that to be the case, and I'm so grateful because you no longer have to deal with the gatekeepers, as I said, and I find, you know, most of the authors I interview on this show are self-published, and they've been very successful in various arenas, and there's also been a rise of, you know, publishing companies online. Some of them specialize just in ebooks. Some do all, you know, all different things, but the point is there's so much out there now that you can choose from, and you can find the path that will work. That will work for you. So, I mean, I think overall it's phenomenal. It's a fantastic time to be an author, I think.
Absolutely, I agree with you 100%. Like I said, the technology's there. As long as a would-be author has the drive, the desire to get their ideas out there, it's so possible for it to happen. And like I said, Adrian was lucky enough to find me. I happen to be a technology expert. I know all about formatting. I know all about document conversion, how to get things on the Internet. And I saw this as really a labor of love. I let Adrian remain true to herself. And I think that's important, too, when you're looking for someone to help you as either an editor or to help you guide you through the process.
Yeah, absolutely.
Quite frankly, Daria, I think in the whole process, of course, I'm in awe of anybody who's got technical smarts, and I'm not sure if people who have technical smarts are in awe of authors, but if I had to choose a job, it would be to write it. I think the writing was simple. I could sit down and write it again, but to put it out there and create what we've created, it's really quite a beautiful book. There's so many pictures and the flow is good, and what Paul did was astounding to me. And I've always had bad computer karma, and yet it's true. There would be things that would happen, and my mind would immediately go to, oh, no, that's it, that's the end. And then I'd look at Paul, and I think, nope, he'll find a way out, he'll figure it out. There was one time when my computer crashed that he lost all the stories. And I remember I was sitting in the bank line waiting for the teller, and he told me, and I realized, Adrian, shut up, just okay, and, you know, deal with it, and my heart dropped. And I just knew he was going to find him. And a couple hours later, he called me up, and he goes, I found him. You know, he doesn't like working with AOL, which is where I am. but he found all the stories. And I mean, there were things with his dedication. They made me wait like 3 weeks to get a hardcover book sent to me, which is what I wanted to give to my son. And I said, it has to be here before April 13th. And, you know, there were due dates and deadlines that we self-imposed. And yet, you know what's the most fun about this entire interview, Daria?
What?
You are a seasoned author. You said 2008. And every time you or Paul refer to me as an author, there's a click in my brain that says, oh, that's me. Do you know what I mean? I'm not
great.
I did it. I am an author, but I haven't resonated yet with the fact. I will, you know, little by little, the book signing tonight will help. I'm an author. Oh, my God. I did it. I one day looked in the mirror and I went, you did it. Because it's something that all of we authors, we know we have it in us. We just don't have the faith that it's going to come out of us.
Yep.
And if it does come out of us, we don't have the faith that it's going to be anything that we're proud of. And so to have done it and be proud of it is a little bit of like dying and going to heaven.
Yeah, it is. It's such a wonderful feeling. It's really, it's hard to convey it, but it is. It's a phenomenal feeling. And you know, Adrian, what was it? So, you know, the first time you held the book in your hands, wasn't that just amazing? You know, when you just looked at it and you held it and...
I have to tell you that I have pictures on my camera of Paul and I, as we called it, pulling the trigger. The last time that we sent the download to Create Space to say, this is the one we want to publish. Because we had, you know, like 5 proofs before that. In my home alone, my girlfriend who came to the dedication, she brought this sort of book kind of frame, and I've got it on my mantle on my fireplace. I have another mantle in my bedroom with a book on it. I have books in my front seat of my car that when I go to the gym, almost every time I walk on the treadmill, I read my book, because my book is a little bit like a Bible. When I tell you the byline that there's a gift in everything, you can look at the most horrific stories of your life, of life itself, and you can find a gift in it. There is no question. I can help you find a gift in it. And so I can get a little bit down or whatever, and I go to my book and I read what I need to read. I read faith, or I read angels, or I read signs or patience. And I've got books in my back seat that I sell wherever I am. I was rear-ended the other day, and the police officer bought a book. And so it's just being very it's universal. It's everybody's life is comprised of stories, and not everybody yet has been fortunate enough to get those stories on paper, and it's really, as I said, cathartic when you do. So, you know, and people have bought them in other towns and just, you know, through circumstance and serendipitousness.
Serendipity.
Thank you. Yeah, I needed Paul for that. Through serendipity, people have gotten their hands on this book that, you know, I don't know that I don't know. And so, yes, it's very exciting. There's books all over my house, and I'm not at all bored with them. The book is 110 short stories, so there's a lot of information in there. And it goes back to, I think, the first story that I recited was from 1959. So I don't want to tell you how old I am, but I'm pretty old.
Now, the book is available, Adrian, in paperback. Is it also available in Kindle and some of the electronic formats?
Where Paul and I thought that it was going to be available in ebook, Kindle, and we still have yet to contact them and find out, but it's supposed to be there. If it's not, we will get there because Paul knows how to do that. It's available through me. May I give out my address?
Please do, yes.
My email address is yoadrianm@aol.com, which is yoadrianm@aol.com, and I would be glad to receive inquiry and ship out books if necessary. You can also get it at Create Space, and the address is www.createspace.com. www.barnesandnoble.com/414-2235. And it is available at Barnes & Noble by special request. And I hope to have it available perhaps with a publisher eventually. I'm not in a big hurry, but it seems to be percolating out there.
Okay. Now, are there any plans? I know that Paul's the technology wizard here. Are there any plans to maybe start promoting on social media? You know, Twitter, Facebook, perhaps a blog. Any plans down the road for something like that?
Well, actually, we've already started promoting on Facebook. Many of my friends have also inquired simply because I am the editor. And we've developed a whole new set of friends as a result of the promotion. And there is a lot of interest in this, more so than I really expected in the beginning of this project. And I'm just happy that it is plugging along. I think it's exceeded Adrian's dreams already, and I think we're going to go a lot further with this project.
I do want you to know that I would like to find, I asked Paul and I've asked a few people, if they know somebody who's really good at social media, like a kid maybe, because they seem to be the best at it. I would love to find somebody. Now, I heard you, when you were announcing you, that you are a social media blog person. If there's anything that we can do to get together or anybody who's a starving kid student, I would love somebody. I don't want to promote it myself except for what I am doing, and I would love somebody to help promote it. That's my next step.
Fabulous. Well, Adrian, we'll talk offline. I would love to chat with you more about that because there's a huge, huge writers community on Twitter, especially, and certainly on Facebook. Blogging is huge. So there's a lot we can talk about offline for sure. The reason, too, for me now, I'm ghostwriting a book for a client and I'm getting ready. I'm kind of laying the groundwork for all of the social media promoting that I'm going to be doing for him. So, yeah, it's incredible, really, what's available online and how you can promote and the success that, I mean, I've interviewed people that have had just tremendous success with social media marketing. So it's great.
Before you go any further, I just want to tell you that you are wonderful at what you do today as far as this interview. You have asked all the right questions. You have listened impeccably. You have never interrupted. And when we're done with our sentence, you've picked up the pause in an instant to continue on along the lines that we were talking, and I have to thank you. It's been a wonderful, wonderful experience. I think you're great at what you do.
Oh, thank you, Adrian. Makes me feel really great. Well, and I'm so glad you could both join me. And Paul, that reminds me, I don't want to go off the air without you being able to put in a plug for your business, because you repair computers and tell us a little bit about what you do and how people can reach you.
Okay. Well, my primary company name is PMG. Quality Computer Services, and I prefer to be contacted by phone at area code 954-536-7862. And it's kind of funny, the way my business has developed, I have never had to advertise. I have simply been built up via word of mouth for my customers.
That's great.
Repeat the number. Oh, I've turned her into a marketing guru now. Again, that number, folks, is 954-536-7862. I'd love to hear from you. Now, and also, repairing computers is not just what I do. I also provide a number of computer-related services. I do document conversions. I develop imaging systems. I teach Excel programming, how to use Microsoft Word and other Office products. I also do business process improvements. I've spent almost 30 years in computer science from all angles, including project development, project enhancements, business development, and implementation. So I have an array of skills that I can apply at any given moment for whatever the customer wants.
Excellent. And are you available for editing services still as well, if somebody's listening?
After all I've been through with Adrian in birthing this baby, yes, absolutely. It is now another weapon in my arsenal, so to speak. I really enjoyed the process, especially once we finished. But, it was quite a learning experience along the way. And, there's really nothing that is that difficult to accomplish once you have the procedures under your belt. And the same is true about computers. I mean, it's not rocket science. It's just a matter of practical experience.
So in other words, if you hear him correctly, he's ready whenever I'm ready for volume two. Right, Paul?
You've got it, kid.
Well, I, the time has gone by so fast. I really enjoyed this interview, and I want to thank you both for joining me. And, Adrian, I'm going to see. I might be able to surprise you tonight and stop by your book signing. So,
I would love that. That would be wonderful. You know where Royal Palm Plaza is?
Oh, yeah. I'm right down the street from there. So.
Okay, well, I'm going to plug it again. It's Yaakov Gallery, and it takes place between 6 o'clock and 10 p.m., and I will be there, and a couple of other writers will be there, and I'm so looking forward to seeing you. That'd be great, Daria.
Oh, yeah, it definitely would. I'm pretty sure I can, so I will see you tonight. That's going to be really exciting. And thank you both again. Thank you so very much. Okay, take care. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. All right, ladies and gentlemen, please get a copy of Adrian Mallon's book, Mother Love, Now and After I'm Gone. I put a link to the Amazon.com page in the chat room. Check it out. If you're local in the area, stop by Adrian's book signing. That's going to be exciting. So, all right, I'm going to take a quick break here, a little commercial break before I bring on my second guest. And we're going to take a little bit of a sobering turn here in the second part of the Write Stream show. My next guest is author Balazs Szabo, and he is a survivor of, communism in Hungary. And he escaped Hungary as a young teenager during the 1956 uprising, and he's written a book about it called Knock in the Night. And it's so powerful. I'll tell you, this book stayed with me for days after I read it. And it's not just a documentation of his experience of, you know, oppression and brutality at the hands of the communists, the Russian communists and the communists within Hungary that were controlling people's lives and confiscating property and separating family members and in many cases taking people's lives. It's also a sobering warning for us here in the United States about what can happen to freedom if we don't fight for it and if we don't remain eternally vigilant. So please stay tuned after these commercial breaks for author Balazs Szabo, and we're going to be talking about his book, Knock in the Night.
Hi, this is Lisa Tarvis. I'm a metaphysician, board-certified holistic health practitioner, energy healer, intuitive, and the author of the book, Just Believe. I'm also a host on the Write Stream Network. My radio show is called Just Believe and airs every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern. Please stop by my website at www.lisatarvis.com. That's LISATARVES for details on all the services I offer, information on my book, and my radio show. There are many amazing guests and fascinating topics scheduled for the show in the upcoming months. I look forward to connecting with you soon.
I'll never get used to these 10-mile runs. They are taking so much time out of my day.
Are you training for a marathon or something?
Diabetes runs in my family, and I heard if you lose lots of weight, you can prevent it. So I started running like crazy, and I cut my calories big time.
Oh, get real. You don't have to knock yourself out to prevent diabetes. My doctor said it's the small lifestyle changes you make that matter, because it's easier to stick to them.
Wow, really?
It worked for me. 6 months ago, I started walking a lot and I stopped eating the fried stuff. I've lost 10 pounds. My doctor said I'm doing great.
I'll have to ask my doctor about this. I'd love to get my life back.
Talk to your healthcare provider. Losing a small amount of weight by being active 30 minutes 5 days a week and eating healthier can prevent type 2 diabetes. To get your free game plan for preventing type 2 diabetes, call 1-800-438-5383. This is a message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the National Diabetes Education Program.
In a moment, cancer changed our lives forever.
We were told nothing could be done to enjoy these final moments together.
But in that moment, when all seemed lost, St. Jude Children's Research Hospital gave us hope.
Because at this moment, St. Jude Children's Research Hospital is saving lives with pioneering research and care. We're changing the way the world treats childhood cancer by sharing our discoveries with doctors and scientists everywhere.
And will never have to pay St. Jude for anything ever.
At this moment, she wants to be in her own bed.
I want to be back at school with my friends.
I want to be outside playing.
Please take a moment and join St. Jude in finding cures and saving children. Visit stjude.org.
Hi, this is Daria Ann, author and founder of the RightStream Radio Network. If you're an author, writer, blogger, or just someone who enjoys reading and learning, I hope you'll tune in to our inspiring, insightful, and educational programs. Every Sunday, join author and metaphysician Lisa Tarvez for Just Believe at 1 p.m. Eastern, when she explores a variety of spiritual topics, including alternative healing modalities. A gifted intuitive from a young age, Lisa's book, entitled Just Believe, chronicles her journey from a childhood of seeing and communicating with angels to a career in which she uses her talents to help others emotionally, spiritually, and physically. Each week, she interviews experts in the fields of personal growth, spiritual development, and alternative medicine. Military Mondays with author and military historian John D. Gresham analyzes current events and issues from the perspective of the United States military. Tune in at 1 p.m. Eastern every Monday when John, author of such books as Uncommon Valor and journalist for the Defense Media Network, interviews accomplished guests on important topics like national security and defense and global terrorism. RightStream Tuesdays with Daria Ann airs at 1 p.m. Eastern and welcomes authors in diverse genres, including romance, drama, military history, spirituality, and politics. We also speak social, discussing the benefits and pitfalls of social media platforms and the numerous and plentiful publishing formats now available with various experts in order to help other authors navigate through new technology to reach higher levels of success. During every broadcast, we welcome your calls at 347-945-7246. And of course, the chat room is always open. Can't listen live? No worries. Just go to blogtalkradio.com/rightstream to listen to the archives. And be sure to join us for our weekly Thursday RightStream Twitter chat at 11 a.m. Eastern using the hashtag RightStream on Twitter. Rejoice in the flow of creativity with the RightStream Radio Network and the RightStream Twitter chat. All right, ladies and gentlemen, and we are back, and I am so excited to welcome the second author today, my second guest, Balaj Sabo. And as I wrote on my blog, I wanted to give him a brief introduction here before I go ahead and bring him on the air. Balaj is the author of Knock in the Night. And this is a hard-hitting book. It's a harrowing real-life tale of surviving the Hungarian uprising against the oppressive Soviet occupation back in 1956 and the author's subsequent escape to the USA as a political refugee. And, you know, I got to tell you, with everything going on recently, certainly within the last 5 years, and I'd even say even longer than that, in this country, I think it's absolutely critical that we as Americans especially listen to people like Balaj Sabo, who's been there, done that, lived it, and, you know, thankfully is still here to tell the story. I'm just going to read a brief description from the book jacket, and then we're going to go ahead and bring him on the air so we can delve into this book and find out more about his career as an artist as well, because he is a phenomenal artist, very multi-talented man. Okay, so from Knock in the Night. Government secret police with machine guns are ordered to fire into a crowd. Men, women, and children are slaughtered at the nation's parliament. 50 years ago, the world held its breath as a nation rose up against tyranny and terror. The event was the 1956 Hungarian Revolution, when a small nation dared to challenge their Soviet oppressors. Though a bloody defeat, the uprising revealed to the world the true nature of communism, which rules by terror. World-renowned artist Balaj Sabo knows that terror firsthand. Knock in the Night is the artist's cautionary memoir of growing up under communist brutality. This extraordinary book vividly recounts those desperate times and is an urgent reminder that where there is no democracy, there is no safety. So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, I welcome artist and author Balazs Szabo to Rightstream Tuesday. Hello, Balazs.
Afternoon, Darianne. Thank you for having me on your show.
Oh, my gosh. It's my pleasure. I'm so excited that you're joining us today. And Balazs, there's so much I want to say to you, but to me, you're a real-life hero. I mean, we live in a culture that worships celebrities and athletes. But for me, somebody like you is a genuine hero, somebody that's survived the most horrific of circumstances and is sharing his experience in the hope of preventing it from happening again. So, you know, Balazs, tell us a little bit about yourself, and then we'll delve into Knock in the Night and get into some more specific topics. But I want to give you the opportunity to introduce yourself to the audience first.
Well, let's start from the beginning. I am a refugee, which means I ran away from another political system and ended up in America to find safety from tyranny, as my book suggested. I was 13 and a half years old, and my parents were under house arrest, and there was really no hope for us, and I somehow got the courage to steal away from the house and from the house arrest. And I don't want to ruin the book for you and tell you all the details, but I managed to get out and escaped the following day across the border through many harrowing experiences. And fortunately, my parents were able to follow me as well a day later. But we crossed at the same time almost in different areas of the border. And I spent 3 weeks in a camp in Austria. There are many refugee camps with hundreds of thousands of people escaping from Hungary. And believe it or not, after seeing three or four camps with thousands of people, my stepmother actually found me in one of the rooms with 50 people lying on the hay. That was our bed.
Wow.
I was very excited because they told me the next day I'm going to get American clothes and cotton socks and wool socks. And, oh, that was to me such a... So my mother opened the door and she says, Balazs, are you there? This was 3 o'clock in the morning. And I woke up and I said, Mom, yeah, I'm here, but why are you coming today? Tomorrow I'm getting my American clothes. So my emotional response was gone. You know, I'm so excited about American clothes. You know, anything American was so important for us people living under communism. But anyhow, so we came to this country together. And my father was the most famous actor in Hungary at the time, in the ranks of Olivier, the British actor. He was given a scholarship, Rockefeller scholarship. And he learned English so excellently that within a year, he was on Off-Broadway, and as life would have it, he was playing a Russian general in The Three Sisters from Chekhov.
Talk about irony, right?
After escaping the Russians, I mean, but anyhow, yeah. So, yeah, go ahead, ask me a question.
Sure. Well, Balazs, you know, just from my perspective, God, your book is so valuable for so many reasons, and God, we could go on and on about this. I think it's all by design, but it really alarms me that so many people in this country, while we still live in relative freedom, have such a romanticized notion of what communism is. And I think one of the biggest lessons of your book is really kind of setting the record straight from someone who's been there, done that. And yet, in the midst of all this horror and oppression, I think, you know, I mentioned Ordinary Heroes, you know, when we first started the interview, and I think one of the other great values of your book is that it demonstrates what the human spirit can do even under the worst of circumstances, and certainly your grandparents. Why don't we start with that? I mean, your grandparents are shining examples of that. Without giving away too much of the story, tell us a little bit about your grandparents and how really their what I'll call their education of you and kind of setting you straight and sort of deprogramming you after you got out of communist school every day really sort of kept you aware of what was going on while they were simultaneously protecting you.
Well, at first, it begins with the fact that my parents divorced when I was 3.5 years old, and there were two children, my older brother and myself, and the communist government solved these problems by splitting the family, giving the younger child to the mother and the older to the father. In this case, my mother didn't want me, and I was so fortunate she gave me to her parents, who were absolutely the most wonderful people. My grandfather was a self-educated man from a very poor family of five children abandoned by a father. And he struggled and he became an attorney and a successful man in the regime before the communists took over Hungary. My grandmother came from a wealthy family, German family, and they married. They actually had to elope because her family didn't want him to be married to her because she was he was not as successful from a class that she was. But, you know, make a long story short, when the communists came in, what they did, the regime punished everybody who was successful from the last regime, and they confiscated all their properties and confiscated their pension to starve them because he was termed as an intelligentsia or a bourgeois. It didn't matter whether he was self-made man or not. And he was therefore to be starved out. And so he was so loved by the people in the area where he ended up that the farmers helped him and taught him how to farm and do things. And so we survived from that. And my grandparents raised me. And every time I went to the communist schools where there was brainwashing, which is very similar to Common Core that's coming to the United States, and every aspect of it is exactly copied from Common Core. My grandparents knew that it's so dangerous that children are so easily influenced, and they didn't want me to be a little communist, just like the fascists used to have the Nazi youth, and they were brainwashed as well. So to prevent that, every time I came home, they asked me what I learned. They looked at my books, told me the truth. My grandfather was very educated about American law and told me about the founding fathers and the concept of freedom. And so it was an absolutely healthy environment to come home to because I would have ended up to be a communist like most of my friends did.
Absolutely. And Balazs, I also want to stress, too, that you also had to be – they had to be extremely careful not to be overheard. Because I don't think – you know, we as Americans who've always had our freedom, I think so many of us can't relate to that feeling of you're in your own house and yet you've got to be so incredibly careful that no one's overhearing you telling your grandson about freedom, about America's founding fathers. Tell us a little bit about that. I mean, what that was like.
Yeah, the system is to isolate people from each other, which is happening here in America under different names. You know, the political correctness is another isolationist method. People don't dare to say their opinions if it differs from other people because they're afraid of some sort of either socially being not liked or maybe if they work, they will not be recognized because they have different concepts. That's what the Soviets did. That's what the Nazis did as well. All totalitarian rulers do that. They separate people from each other, the rich from the poor, the black from the white, the different religions. And also they work on the children to tell on their parents, and they want to know what the conversations are at home. And if the conversations are against the ruling agendas of the government, then they will, retaliate many ways. They retaliate by people not getting promotions at work, or they lose their jobs, or any number of things. Torture, they beat them. Sometimes you never see them. They send them to Siberia or to other political prison camps, and so people live in fear all the time, and certainly they, at that point, will not express their opinions about the government or the political system because they want to survive. And so my grandparents had to be very, very careful to make me understand as a little boy that I have to really guard their freedom and their safety. And luckily, as a child, I realized how frightening it would be for me to lose my grandparents, and I held to that preciously.
Mm. Wow, it's incredible. And, you know, it's almost as if, you know, and it's funny, Balaj, I interviewed another author recently who survived the Cambodian killing fields, and, you know, that was communism as well. And it's like the MO seems to be the same. And, of course, you know, was it Stalin that, and maybe it was Lenin that talked about, you know, getting the children and brainwashing them early, which is what you were alluding to. And it's just all about just killing the human spirit, literally, whether it's literally killing them or whether it's just breaking people's spirit to keep them submissive and easily controlled by government. And it's just horrific. Go ahead.
It's really frightening because it's all happening. Everything I experienced as a child under communism, all the tricks, it's all happening in America under a different color, different face, different names. But actually, it's all the same. This, the system to control others and to take away their freedom is one and the same in every regime like that. It's a very, very sick thing because in America, it's coming very, very slowly. It's been for 80 years, it's been going on here. And, of course, in Europe and other parts of the world, this was a much faster process because it was always after a war when they had no food, the cities were completely demolished, and people looked for any governmental help and anybody. They didn't care whether it was the fascist or whether it was a communist. They just wanted to have food and they wanted to survive. So here, it's amazing how they're doing it very slowly. They're doing the same destruction as a war would by financially destroying this country. And the only way we can destroy this country is first break its economy. Printing money is one of the things that the Germans did. We're doing it now. Hitler, the first thing he did, he took over the healthcare system because it's an enormous control over the people's lives, and it's an enormous amount of money stolen from the people. And so all of these things are big red flags, literally red flags to me, because everything is going in that direction. Today, I was working out with a young man who's got children in school, two little daughters. One of them is 6 years old and the other one is 9. And both of them had to do sort of a mock voting in school just recently. Now, the older one is more affected by the parents who are Republicans and conservatives. I should use constitutionalists because now, you know, these terms are getting really watered down, and I, you know, the Republicans in Washington D.C. are not really Republicans; they're prostitutes to the left. But the thing is with his children, they voted, and the older girl voted for Romney, and the younger one, who was 5 or 6, voted for Obama. And the father asked the children why, and so the little one, she says, well, everybody was in my class voting for Obama, and I just didn't want them to think there's something wrong with me.
Mm.
And so can you see already the pressures of society on the children, political pressures? I mean, this is so frightening to me because this is the, you know, the germination of that fear of political correctness already at the age of 6. Isn't that awful?
Oh, it's chilling. Truly. And, it, you know, and it goes back to, and it's funny, you know, and I'll just throw in my personal experience here. I mean, I'm a product of a Catholic school. However, if not for having constitutional conservative parents at home, I might have been brainwashed too, because, you know, everybody talks about the social justice now, you know, and Glenn Beck certainly has brought that to light. You know, thankfully he has, but it was nothing new to me. I mean, the nuns and the priests, for the most part, bought into that stuff too, you know, way back when, you know, when I was, you know, Ronald Reagan was president when I was in high school, and, you know, and I heard them say terrible things about him. And then I would go home, and in a sense, just like you were saying with your grandparents, my mom would deprogram me, Balaj, too. So,
right.
And that's even in the case of a you know, parochial school. So we've got to be vigilant
in
all areas.
Very, very essential in our country. I mean, this is why 80 or so years ago, the left took over the educational system through the government. In America, and that's why about 4 generations of this country, people know nothing about their own values. They have knowledge of their own history or world history, as a matter of fact, so they don't know what to fear. And, of course, in a country like ours, which is still today free, freedom brings with it laziness, too.
Mm-hmm.
And if somebody doesn't beat it in your little head in school, you're not going to go out and search knowledge and get an idea. That's why Americans have such a tremendous identity crisis, and they're apologetic about America. I meet Americans all the time, and they're constantly apologizing for America. This is so frightening to me, and this is all because of the brainwashing. Even the adults have been affected by this whole regime, where it constantly apologizes for us Americans, where all we have to do is be proud of who we are. Nowhere in history, nowhere in Europe, anywhere in the world has it ever happened. What happened in my observation in America, when I first came here in 1956, what was happening to black people throughout for the last 100 years or 150 was a sad part of history, but you know, slavery was in every country all over the world. The Jews were slaves for thousands of years. Other people were slaves. And the last group of slaves, unfortunately, were the African Americans, you know, on our continent. And the Americans, what they've done for the blacks since 1960s is unprecedented. It's the most beautiful thing, how people gave up the education of their own children to allow other kids from the slums to take, you know, going to colleges, even though they're, you know, their grades weren't as good, to prepare them, to help them out. And as a result, there are hundreds of thousands, not millions, of black people in America who today prosper and should be proud of themselves. Dr. Carson is a perfect example. And
yeah.
I have another friend who became the mayor, in Detroit, and he's also a product of this. And Americans have so many things to be proud of. I mean, they saved Europe from all the fascism, and it's pretty much, you know, Ronald Reagan overcame the communists, so communism wasn't that bad afterwards. It's, of course, it's still lingering and coming back because there's so much corruption in that part of the world. But Americans have responded to every problem in the world immediately, not just by military, but personally. Thousands of Americans are all over the world helping people in AIDS and helping poor people in different countries. And no other country does this. America is the most generous country in the world by far, and every person in America. When I came to this country, 60,000 or more refugees came to America in 1956. We were all helped and aided, and people were loving and patient with us. And I had an American family who paid for my schools. I went to the finest, most expensive schools in America, and so did my brother. This would never happen in Europe. Europeans are rather greedy and rather prejudiced. This does not happen when a whole bunch of refugees come into a country that a European nation would go out and immediately embrace them and help. This is an American character and unique to America. This American exceptionalism is part of that.
Wow, well, you've just given me goosebumps, Balazs, and I do agree with that. I mean, I've seen it firsthand myself as an American, and certainly have participated in similar things. And you know, you mentioned slavery. One of the things that always bothered me, and you make a great point about how slavery existed in just about every other civilization in the world, but no one, you know, even as a child, when I would learn about this in school, I think, in order to have a transaction, in order to have a slave trade, you must have a buyer and a seller. How come nobody's talking about the people that sold their own people into slavery?
Yes,
you know?
Marianne, we're going back to knowing history. If people don't study history, and this is why they don't want people to study history, because people start thinking. And so, you know, Africans, the tribes and thousands of tribes in Africa were in constant battle. They were capturing each other and selling the captured people to whoever wanted to buy them. And this was slavery for thousands of years, not just in Africa, in Arab countries, in China, the Mongols did it. This was just our evolution as humans. This is part of our going up the stairs in development. This is nothing new. This is just nature. And
right.
As I'm saying, the American culture was the only one that actually made reparations for that. No other one's ever done it, you know?
Absolutely.
The Germans had to be forced. So when they did all the atrocities to the Jews, they had to be forced. They had to be first beaten in the war and then forced to do reparations for Jewish people. But Americans didn't have to be forced. It was a natural thing that happens here, and it only happens in this kind of a country with this kind of laws and this kind of mentality, the mentality of freedom that does not exist anywhere in the world.
Yeah, no, and I agree with that 100%, Balazs. And, you know, just one other thing I want to comment, and then I want to get into talking about your book again and how you wrote it. But, you know, I think also, I mean, there's been a deliberate, as you mentioned, you know, a deliberate attempt by the left and the government to take over education, to brainwash people. Because when you study history, you look at the founding fathers, you realize that, yes, they were ordinary men, that they did something extraordinary. I mean, they were living in a world dominated by oligarchies, monarchies, dictatorships, and here they get together and they conceive of a government that in which the individual is in control of his or her own destiny, where the individual reigns supreme. And I think, and it's been deliberate, but we as Americans, through the education system, through pop culture, through the media, have lost sight of what a phenomenal accomplishment that was in the history of the world. And instead, we're brainwashed into believing, well, the founding fathers were racist, they were a bunch of white men, and again, it's all been by design. But when you look at what they have truly accomplished, it's really disheartening to me that so many people have that ridiculous notion in their head.
And our president is stuck in the Malcolm X era. You know, I read Malcolm X's book, and even Malcolm X eventually came out of that sick way of thinking of the reverse prejudice. And so much happened, as I say, in America, in racism. So for this administration to constantly fester and look for differences to separate us is typically of the dictators, because that's how they create this constant ongoing revolution, and which is a communist idea, to constantly find people and make them feel disenfranchised, because once you make them feel disenfranchised, you can use that weapon against another group. And this is all to destroy a culture. And once you destroy a culture, you can replace it with whatever you want, you have in hand, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
So education is the only defense, and the founding fathers always said that the citizens have to be educated properly. And our only solution is to take over D.C. and replace everybody there, because everybody has become so corrupt through the last 8 decades that very few people are worth keeping. And we should have term limits on these people, and we should get back into people controlling them, and then we can change the educational system, because it's no longer they who are telling our children what to study and our teachers.
Right.
You know,
absolutely. We need to abolish the Department of Education, and it needs to go back to the states or privatized altogether, in my opinion.
We're being attacked from so many sides. Every day you notice a new area where this cancer is spreading, you know, and now we have this terrible thing with the IRS, and that's exactly what the communist government did, is to punish people that didn't agree with them, and the IRS is in. And obviously it all leads back to the president, even though he says he has nothing to do with it. He washes his hands from everything. And this is why all the Benghazi things can happen here, because we are no longer transparent. It's the government doing everything secretly. And it's so obvious that that ambassador was involved with running guns to the Muslim Brotherhood. And that's why Obama let him die in there, because he knew too much and he didn't want this kind of stuff to come out. And that's why they said, stand down. You know, let these people die. Maybe he'll be buried with them. Unfortunately, it wasn't. And maybe something will come to the surface. I mean, it's not, you don't have to be very smart to see through what's going on.
Yeah, absolutely. And we the people, and especially I think Twitter has been such a powerful medium to hold these people accountable. And, you know, I'll use the case of Kermit Gosnell, too, who thankfully was just convicted on, I think, 4 counts of murder. Should have been higher, but I'm glad he got convicted. If not for social media, if not for Twitter, the media, the traditional media would have let that story die, pardon the pun. So, you know, we have so much more power now as everyday citizens because we have this alternative media. So we have to keep up the fight, Balazs. But I want to talk about your book now. Well, and I want to talk about also your career as an artist. So tell us a little bit about how that developed. I mean, it's amazing to me, in spite of having, you know, your beginnings, you know, living under this horrific regime, that your natural talent and abilities sort of came out and your grandfather took notice. And then thankfully, when you came to America, you were able to pursue that. So tell us about that. And then we'll get into a little bit of a discussion about, you know, how you decided to sit down and start writing your book.
Okay. Well, you know, fundamentally, it all begins with the genes. So you can say you didn't build that. You know, my grandfather was a very talented artist. I wanted to be an artist, but knowing in those time in 1887 that you don't make a living as an artist that easily, and coming from a poverty-stricken family, he really wanted to make it in society. So he became a Sunday painter. He painted beautifully. And in the end, he saved our lives because many times when we were starving and we had nothing, he traded his art for food, which was the most painful thing for me to watch.
Aww.
And my grandmother's sister was, and both my grandmother and her sister were liberated women, born in 1891, I think, is around there. And when they grew up to be adult ladies, my grandmother was a professor of French and Hungarian literature in the university where she met my grandfather. And her sister, my aunt, was a professor of art in a fine art school in Budapest, which was one of the finest in the world. So I got a little genes from those folks, and so as a child, like all children, you know, children dance, sing, and draw, and paint. You know, I think all human beings are artists until somebody tells them that that doesn't look like a horse, that looks like a dog, you know, then they stop me. And if you encourage people, you know, if you go into societies, so-called, quote-unquote, third world, where there's no TV, everybody's an artist. You know, women embroider and do things and then paint their houses inside with beautiful colors and motifs, and men make beautiful carvings. So human beings by nature are creative people until you neglect that part in them. You know, folks make music called folk music. You know, it's not by people going to academy and learning how to play instruments. They do it on their own. So he was with us, and grandfather sat down with me, and we drew many pictures of the Turks attacking Hungarian castles and things like this. And, you know, it just came along with me as I went through years. I was sketching, and then my father, who was an actor and a very, very brilliant artist, and my stepmother noticed that, really, I should, you know, be encouraged. And so they encouraged me further. When we came to America, I was introduced to one of his friends, a brilliant master, Paul Fried, who survived by running away. He's Jewish, left Paris. He was Hungarian, but he was a student of Renoir. And he left Paris, came to New York, and when he saw my work, he offered to teach me absolutely without fee. Which was a big deal because he was charging a lot of money to teach. You know, can you imagine being a student of Renoir? He was brilliant. And so he said, Balazs, the only way I'm going to teach you, if you promise me you're not going to be an artist. He said, be a commercial artist, do anything else, but don't be an artist. You're going to suffer. So obviously he put the bug in my ear, so from that on, I wanted to be an artist, and I didn't want to be a commercial artist. So anyhow, I studied through with him for many years, and then I got a scholarship to Pratt Institute in New York, full scholarship. And I attended a few classes, and I saw that I was so beyond that school. I knew so much more that I returned the scholarship. And since I worked the whole summer as a carpenter, I had enough money because the dollar in those days was very good. And I took a ship and went to Austria and entered and got in the Austrian Fine Arts Academy. And I studied art in Austria. And then from the Fine Arts Academy, I went to the Applied Arts. And I came back for a while, went to Chicago Fine Arts. Then I ended up living in Hawaii, went to Honolulu Fine Arts. And these were, of course, years and years. My career as an artist was already going. And then went back. I got a scholarship in 1971 in Budapest Fine Arts. Went back for a year and further my education. I never stayed for any diplomas because I always believed that my teachers in Vienna were so upset with me. They said, well, why don't you want to stay to the diploma? I said, well, listen, I'm not going to hang my diploma on a gallery wall. I'm going to hang my art. And if it's no good, the diploma is not going to help me any. And then they said,
but listen
to this. But then the professor says, but you could teach then. And I said, yeah, like I would end up like you, a failure artist teaching art. I'm going to be teaching failing.
Oh, I'm sure they love that.
I didn't like that very much. So that did. And of course, I had a one-man show in Chicago, and we sold all my paintings. I got ripped off by the gallery, so I went at night to a law school and learned how not to be cheated ever again, so it never happened to me after that. And then I ended up working for United Artists, but first it was called Liberty Records, and the United Artists Records in Hollywood, and designed many album covers and jackets for famous people like Ike and Tina Turner and 50 Mentions and Gordon Lightfoot and you name it.
Oh, I love him.
I worked for many, many labels. And then the earthquake came in 1971, and I almost died in that. So ended up in Hawaii, and I got a huge mural commission. And the head of the government art council at that time, because a certain percentage of art for public buildings goes to art in Hawaii, was Dr. Alfred Price. And he was the one who designed that beautiful memorial bridge over the Arizona ship that went down in Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he was in, he and the whole committee from Hawaii was, instrumental in giving me my first big commission that really catapulted my career. And then later on, I did 8 murals for a Detroit law firm, Sharpus and Sharpus. I did a lot of private commissions, and my works are in Lawrence Rockefeller collection and other collections as well, the DuPont family. And I learned to get rid of the middleman, and I only exhibit with galleries when I change a state, and then afterwards I do it all on my own. I don't like to give my profit to a middleman, because especially nowadays it's so much easier to communicate your art in the electronic age. You know, all I need is my iPad, and I don't need a portfolio under my arm. I'm much more mobile.
That's great.
You know, you have a website, you can contact people. So my art career took off long, long time ago.
Well, Balazs, speaking of website, let me give you an opportunity to let people know where they can find your artwork. Tell us what your web address is.
Well, my art work is simple. It's my name, first name, balazsart.com, and it's spelled B-A-L-A-Z-S-A-R-T, all in one word, balazsart.com. And we will have this website also on my other website, which is more political and it contains my book and other things, which is knockinthenight.com, all one word, knockinthenight, is no space in between. Because I don't paint political pictures, so you know, I actually, probably your next question was about how I wrote the book. I simply came to the idea that I'm going to let my children know more in detail of my childhood because I've had such a good life here. And they've traveled the world with me, so they have a very good vision and understanding of the difference of America to, compared to other countries. But I wanted them to have it in a pamphlet sometime, and nothing serious. And so I had papers lying around for about 17 years, and then one day I lost two of my best friends within 3 weeks of each other. And they were all healthy guys, and one of them I was supposed to be on an airplane with, and so just by the fact that I had an exhibition that night, I wasn't with him in his plane, and he crashed and died on the way back from Florida to come to my exhibition. So
oh, God.
I thought, oh, my God, this is, you know, this can happen to me. I better sit down and write a book, and I was very broken up. And so for the next 8 months, I was writing my book 8 hours a day, and put it every and as I wrote, one memory led to another, and sometimes memories that I deleted in my mind because they're too painful came up to the surface, and I had to handle it, which was very difficult. I think you remember about the little girl who drowned. That I don't want to go into details, but I think you remember the incident, and that was something I had forgotten, and for 50 years, I totally forgot it. And one of the things initiated another. So, and so after I've written my book, I sent it to friends and collectors who were closer to me. And one of the people was Mr. Lee Iacocca. And he responded to me within 3 days and said, I have to publish this book. And I said, well, listen, I publish art books. I don't publish books like this. Nobody knows me from Ella Beans. It won't go anywhere. And I said, well, I tell you what, if you endorse it, I will publish it. And so I had $20,000 lying around to self-publish the book. And so he wrote a very concise, wonderful one sentence in the back of the book, and I published it. And it was a success because of his endorsement, actually. So here's another example of a generous American.
Yeah. Now, well, and he was also very smart because he knew quality when he knows quality when he sees it. Now, Balazs, you started Refugee Press. I mean, that's your own self-publishing company. Is
yes,
that correct?
Yes. It's because of the things that are happening in technology nowadays, I realize I don't need a middleman for publishing either, because there are just on-demand publishing companies, and all you have to do is use the media, every media you can as a person, social media, and you can communicate. And so just by simply communicating, you're selling thousands of books without having to go through somebody who keeps all the profits. And so Refugee Press was the start of that. So my book is Refugee Press, but I'm also going to publish other people's books with the same theme to educate Americans. And I'm collecting people's stories from all over the world, from every continent, wherever there was dictatorship, and they ended up in America, and have a story to tell, because these are the things that should be taught in schools. And my biggest hope is that my book, like Anne Frank's book, should end up as a compulsory reading in schools.
Yeah.
Especially in colleges where people are really focused on teaching communism to these children. I have two stepdaughters who've been so influenced by going to Dartmouth, so lefty thinking that it just boggles the mind. You know, the parents spend over $500,000 on getting these kids educated just to be turned out to be anti-Americans, you know?
It's unbelievable, absolutely. And Balazs, I agree with you. And I must say, you're very good at anticipating questions, because that was my next question was, you know, with Refugee Press, are you planning to publish the books of others who've had similar experiences to you? And I'm so glad to hear you say that.
I can plug somebody. I'm already in communication with this gentleman. He's in his 80s, and he's written a wonderful book, Adios Havana. And obviously he's Cuban, and his family's here, and they live in Colorado. And I love his book, and I'm working on, and he's interested in having his book on my refugee press. So we're just working on that, and I hopefully it'll be fast, because I want people to read his book as well.
Fantastic. I think what you're doing is invaluable, and I agree with you. I mean, these are the types of books that ought to be part of the curriculum in schools, and I hope it's not too late. It's good to see that people are now awake and paying attention to what's going on in the public education system. I mean, you mentioned Common Core. I have several friends who are involved in the pushback against that, and it's great to see that. And, we the people just have to band together to prevent this from happening. But I agree with you. I mean, especially with colleges, I mean, not only are these kids being indoctrinated, but you're paying a hell of a lot of money for that indoctrination, and it's just, again, it's just very disheartening. But and that's why I admire people like you so much, because you have it's not that others, that we don't have the legitimacy, but you have the legitimacy of saying, I've been there, I've lived through it, I can tell you what it's about from my own personal experience. And I think that's such a powerful thing. And Balaj, I just wanted to tell you, I think I might have talked to you about this on Twitter, but years ago my mom and I went to see a movie called American Rhapsody. And it was based on the real-life experience of a Hungarian couple, same situation, same time frame with the communists. I think the husband was a very successful publisher. They were really good people. They had two little daughters, and they managed to get out with the older daughter, and the plan was for the baby to be kind of delivered the next day, and the whole plan went awry, and it ended up this little girl's grandmother was afraid to hand her over to the person who was supposed to sneak her across the border, because she was afraid that something was going to happen to her. So the little girl ends up out in the country with this childless couple, and she lives with them for 7 years and starts to think of them as her parents. And meanwhile, her mom and dad and sister, who came to America, spend the next 7 years lobbying to get her back, and they finally do. And the whole movie is really like her experience of coming here and being like a fish out of water. But my whole point in telling you this story is that while my mom and I were in the movie theater trying to figure out what we wanted to watch, the first showing of American Rhapsody was coming out. So we stopped this woman and we said to her, oh, how was that movie? What was it about? And her description of it was so superficial and so stupid. And I don't even know. And for some reason, my mom and I said, oh, okay, let's go see that if it's funny. And here it was a movie about people escaping communism and enduring the heartbreak of separation from their child for 7 years. And we looked at each other at the end and we thought, how can Americans be so blind? I mean, did we watch the same movie? And it's just staggering to me that was her perception when my mom and I were watching it going, oh my God, everybody should see this movie. Go ahead. So
I know, I've seen the movie. It's bizarre to have that kind of a reaction. I can't believe it. But see, that's what happens in our horrible educational system. People are dumbed down, and that's exactly how they want them, because how can you have them, by the millions go to vote for Obama and his regime was going to destroy them unless they're dumbed down, Anybody with half intelligence and some common sense can see so many of these things. They don't have to live in a communist country or escape one like I had. All you have to have is a little bit of a common sense, but that's the problem. People are totally unread, and really we foreigners know a lot more about the laws and the things in this country that are of value than the people who grow up in it. But, there's a saying, if you're born in warm water, you don't know it's warm,
Yeah.
You have to change the water temperature. So, and the frog in America has been slowly boiled for 80 years, and people don't know that they're being boiled because now I'm glad that Obama is doing all these speeding up of all these terrible things against this country and the principles of this country, because people are now beginning to realize it. And if he would have done it slow like they've done it up to this point, people may not have known it. Maybe it would have been too late, but maybe people are waking up. All I can say is maybe. I would like to have a renaissance in America, and that would be a fantastic thing, because that would save the whole world if we would have a renaissance of our laws and of our respect for freedom and a patriotism, a healthy patriotism, not a nationalism, which America never had, thank God. We always had patriotism. It was a big damn difference, and Europeans and all those countries had nationalism, which was horrible. Maybe this country can be saved. That's probably why I wrote the book, and that's why I speak to people daily. I speak to everybody. I can be in a line to pay a food line and a bill, and I'll be talking to somebody. I don't care.
Yep. Well, and you know, Balaj, I'm glad you said that, because I think that old adage that's been so prominent in this country, you know, never discuss religion or politics, I think it has done a tremendous amount of damage. And again, it's another extension of keep people dumb. Let's talk about stupid things like celebrities, and let's not talk about important things like freedom and individual liberty and why it's important to keep an eye on what's going on in the government. You know, people for way too long have tended to think of politics as something that happens outside of them that has nothing to do with them, when in fact decisions that are made in Washington have everything to do with your life. And you better get engaged, you know.
I don't remember that saying, whether it was Benjamin Franklin or somebody said something that if you don't take part of politics, politics will take part of you, or something like that. You know, and it's so true, and you can't be laid back on that, because politics is every minute of our lives, every breath, everything we do, or everything our politicians do affect our lives, and of course it goes again back to the lack of education, you know, and lack of understanding history.
Absolutely.
You know, all this language changing our culture, you know, social studies. It's not social studies, it's history. Everything is being changed, so we don't recognize our own culture, you know?
No, it's the truth. Yeah, and then another saying comes to mind, too, and you mentioned it about, like, boiling the frog. You don't know what you have until it's gone, but I hope that that's not true in this case. I hope that enough of us are awake that we know now what we stand to lose, and we'll be able to prevent it. And I think, you know, books like yours and people like you, I think you're the ones that are going to, if we're going to be saved, I think it's going to happen because of people like you speaking out and being willing to write these books. And as you say, talk to people while you're standing in line at the supermarket and just not be afraid. I think that's another thing. I think my friend Risa LaRue Kirkland, who goes by War Chick on Twitter, she doesn't call it political correctness. She calls it political castration. And I think she's absolutely right. We're so castrated, we can't even speak to each other about these important things.
And it's really our duty as people who come here and have been given refuge by you guys and this wonderful country to give back by saving, because we see it better. And, you know, I always say that Americans have all the excuse, and I grant it to them, because when you grow up in freedom, thank God you don't have the knowledge of all this evil. And we have to prevent you guys to having it. So I just want you to read about it. I don't want you to experience it. I want to help with all sorts of people, other refugees who know, to save you guys from this, because no one should experience the things we have experienced in order to leave our country. Everybody loves their country. Nobody wants to leave their country. Nobody wants to leave their language, their culture, their poetry. I mean, you know, we're heartbroken leaving our places, and everybody should be able to stay where they are if there would be freedom around the world, and that's what America's been trying to do for as long as it's been around, is help other people to have the same freedoms so they can stay home, so they don't have to go across borders legally or illegally, you know?
Yes. Yep, exactly. And that is so true. And you know, and gosh, that's a whole other topic, Balaj, we could get into, is the right to, you know, to control your own borders, because every other country in the world does it. But we're kind of running out of time. So I wanted to, in the last few minutes, is there anything that we haven't discussed that you'd like to add to the conversation here today?
I'm writing a children's book.
Excellent. Okay, and along the same lines, to try to educate children about freedom?
We had a pet bird from Hawaii that we saved. There was a preemie. An egg fell out of a gutter and crashed, and there was a premature animal in it. And we saved it, and he became part of our lives for 9 years, and he never knew he was a bird. He opened his eyes, and he printed. So he lived inside, outside. You know, whenever we opened the door, he flew out. But we had great times with him, great experiences. And so through that, I introduced a little bit of Hawaii, and then we moved to mainland, as Hawaiians call us, to Connecticut and here. He finally died here in North Carolina, and I'm writing a book and trying to find out all my old movies so we can also have a little, little DVD of the bird's life because it's a true story. I'll mail it to you. It's almost done.
Oh, I'm excited. We'll have to bring you back on to talk about it, Balazs, too.
Yeah, it'll be done within a month, so we might be talking soon.
Well, that sounds good. And I want to tell everyone, too, to also follow you on Twitter, and it's at Balazs Art, and that's B-A-L-A-Z-S-A-R-T on Twitter.
Yes,
and
correct.
Balazs, I got to get you tweeting more. That's one of my goals with you.
Oh, you've been an absolute angel, and thank you so much for following me. And any way I can help to move this country toward the right direction, I'll be doing it through you, I guess.
Oh, I would love that. It would be an honor. And, definitely. And I want to remind everybody again to pick up a copy of your book at knockinthenight.com. That's Balazs' website. And, you know, please read it and, most importantly, share it. I mean, read it, buy a copy for friends, family members, anyone you know that's still kind of resistant to what's going on or doesn't think that we're under assault here or that our freedoms are at stake, please buy a copy of this book and pass it on.
Thank you. And it's also available in e-books too, so you don't have to get the hard copy.
Okay. So, and Balazs, is it available as a Kindle?
Yes.
Kindle, Nook? Okay. So in all different formats.
Amazon, just go on Amazon and you can find it there. And get the dark, black copy, the black cover, not the white cover.
Okay. Perfect.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Balazs. God bless you, and we'll talk soon.
Same to you. Thank you. Bye.
Okay. Bye-bye. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, that was Balazs Szabo, author of Knock in the Night. Please get his book. Visit his website, knockinthenight.com. And that is going to wrap up another edition of Right Stream Tuesday here on the Right Stream Radio Network. I hope you enjoyed the show. Please share the archive with your friends and family and contacts. Follow me on Twitter at Daria Ann. That's D-A-R-I-A-A-N-N-E. Follow the hashtag WriteStream. That's W-R-I-T-E-S-T-R-E-A-M. This Thursday on the WriteStream Twitter chat, my friend Robert Bertrand will be our guest, and we'll be talking about various aspects of writing and liberty. You can follow Robert on Twitter at T-Y Capitalism. And so join in the conversation. That'll be Thursday, 11 a.m. Eastern Time till noon on Twitter using the hashtag WriteStream. Until then, stay in the flow of creativity, and I'll see you back here next Tuesday with two more great guests. Take care, everyone.